Chapter 23. Becca Eckersley, Yellowstone National Park, May 19, 2011, 9 months before her death. The senator's call, which woke Jack and Becca early Thursday morning, didn't save their lives. They weren't that dramatic, but it damn well changed them. The chirping phone was an unnatural sound that morning, interrupting the quiet and stillness that took precedence at Yellowstone. Jack rolled over, pushing Becca's arm off his chest as he sat up and searched his bag for the phone. He didn't recognize the number. "Hello?" "Jack?" a man asked, in a cool southern drawl. "Yes?" Jack sat up in his tent, cleared his throat, and pushed the static-filled cell phone to his ear.
"Jack, it's Senator Milt Ward. I worked with you last year through an internship program at GWU.
Jack straightened his back.
"Yes, sir. How are you?"
"In need of a young voice. As you know, I'm making a run next November, and I need some help on my campaign."
"Sir, I'm not sure I heard you."
"I'm offering you a job, son. You'll be putting words in my mouth as one of my speechwriters."
There was dead air for a few seconds. Then the senator said,
"Son, you still there?"
"Yes, sir."
"I just offered you a job, Jack."
"Yes, sir, I'd be honored."
"Good. I'll let you talk to my campaign manager. She'll get you caught up on how things run here. And I'd like to meet tomorrow for dinner."
Sir, I'm out west at the moment, and not exactly able to get back by tomorrow. I'm in Yellowstone Park with no way out for a few days."
"Next week work for you?"
"Yes, sir."
"I'll give you Shirley Wilson's number. She'll arrange for you to get back here."
"I drove out here, sir. Once I get out of the park, it'll take a couple of days to get back to D.C.
"Shirley will set things up. I'll have my plane meet you. It'll be much faster than driving, and we need to meet sooner than later. See you in a few days."
"Senator, you should probably know about..."
Jack paused, not sure if he should offer so much. Becca sat up now, listening to Jack's end of the conversation.
"I had some..."
Jack searched for an appropriate word.
"Issues at school before I left."
There was no reply from the other end, so Jack kept talking.
"With a stolen test." "I've heard Professor Morton is a ball buster, son. I'd have stolen that test too, given the opportunity."
The senator laughed.
"You've been vetted, Jack. I know more about you than you know about yourself, and there's nothing I don't like. Stealing a test to pass a class you couldn't otherwise handle is one thing. Stealing a test and not using it is quite another."
"How do you know I didn't use it?"
"Got ears in the right places, Jack. Take this number down."
Jack scribbled the number of Senator Ward's campaign manager on his hand.
"See you next week, son."
Jack closed his cell phone and looked at Becca.
"Did that just happen?"
"Tell me."
"Senator Ward, from my internship last summer."
"Yeah?"
"He's running for president."
"And?"
"He wants me to write for him."
Chapter 24. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 14, 2012. Day 10. She ate a banana as she walked down Maple Street. It was a cloudless morning with a hint of warmth in the air and the smell of spring all around. Kelsey needed to warn Commander Ferguson of the trouble that was heading his way. She turned on Minnehaha Avenue, walked up the steps and into the old police building. There was no one manning the front, so she walked straight to the commander's office. She found him on his knees behind his desk, rummaging through the bottom drawer. A large cardboard box sat on top of the desk.
"Commander?"
He popped his head over the top of his desk.
"Miss Castle, good morning."
"Sorry to drop by unannounced, but I need to talk to you." He waved her over.
"Come here a minute and help me off this bad knee."
Kelsey hurried around the desk and helped him stand.
"What are you doing?"
She noticed now the office was in disarray. Papers were scattered behind the desk, and nails poked from bare walls where pictures once hung.
As she continued to look around, she understood. "Are you cleaning out your office?" The commander smiled. "It's time." "Because of Madison?"
"Because of a lot of things."
"He came to my suite at the Winchester late last night to tell me to go back to Miami. He saw my research material, some of which had the Summit Lake seal on it." The commander smiled again and shook his head.
"Doesn't matter how he found out. And truthfully," he pointed around his office, "my leaving isn't even a result of that. Retirement was inevitable. I hung in here as long as I could, but now I've got to go. I was hoping to stick around long enough to figure out what happened to the Eckersley girl, but that isn't in the cards for me."
"So Madison is pushing you out?"
"Please. A kid who shaves 3 times a week doesn't have the authority to push me anywhere. The district attorney, however, does. His office asked me to take a leave, and I'm happy to."
"I feel awful, Commander."
"Young lady, don't blame yourself for my problems. The writing's been on the wall for some time. I'm finally getting around to reading it."
He threw some more items into the stuffed box on his desk.
"But do me a favor, will you?"
"Anything."
"Don't let them run you out of here like they did me. I've got politics and pensions to worry about. You follow a different set of rules. I know how close you are to breaking this case, so don't stop until you've got it wrapped. Hear me?"
"Yes, sir." Commander Ferguson smiled. He looked around his office.
"Well, I think that does it. Everything else can stay. I'll leave it to the guys to decide what to do with the rest of this junk."
"Who's taking your spot?"
"The Summit Lake Police Department will be in good hands, whomever they give it to. Help me out to my car?"
"Of course." Kelsey carried a box outside and dropped it into the back of Ferguson's pickup. The commander wiped his hands, looked up at the aging brick building where he spent his entire career.
"That's a wrap."
"Where are you off to?" Kelsey asked.
"I've worked 43 years and never took a sick day. I know it's hard to believe looking at me, but it's true. I'm going to relax a while."
"Where?"
"God only knows, but I'm ready, that's for sure."
He reached into his breast pocket and pulled out a package of cigarettes.
"Do me a favor,"
he said, handing Kelsey the pack. Kelsey raised her eyebrows as she took it.
"Throw these away for me."
"Sure," Kelsey said. He climbed into the pickup and pulled the door shut. His left elbow hung through the open window.
"Be careful, Miss Castle. Madison's out for you. So get your work done quickly, and then get out of here."
He handed Kelsey a card.
"My cell number. Call if you need anything. All you're looking for is 1 or 2 more pieces to fall into place. Everything will come together then."
He started the truck and put it into gear.
"Good luck."
Kelsey waved as he drove down the street and turned onto Maple. The diesel engine rumbled for a few seconds until it faded and he was gone. Chapter 25. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, August 4th, 2011, 6 months before her death. On a steamy day in early August, 3 months since their Yellowstone adventure, Becca moved into her new apartment in the Foggy Bottom neighborhood just west of the GW Law campus. It was, coincidentally, the same neighborhood where Jack settled earlier in the summer, and the 2-block walk between their residences was easy to cover. Law school orientation for 1L students started August 16th. Classes began the 22nd, which gave them 2 weeks before Becca's schedule got crazy. Jack was already working long hours on Milt Ward's campaign, but was granted the weekend to get Becca settled. He traveled intermittently, but the next 2 weeks would see him in D.C., and the heavy lifting would not begin until late fall as they prepared for the Iowa caucus in January. After breakfast and a tour of the law school campus, Becca's parents left Saturday morning. With their arms around each other, Jack and Becca waved as the Eckersleys drove away. Holding hands, they walked back through campus and imagined the coming year.
"You'll be in there a lot," Jack said, pointing to the law library.
"It's going to be weird studying without you. I've been so used to you at the desk across from me. I'll either have to go it alone or find another guy to study with."
Jack smiled. "I think you're a loner."
"I guess I won't have time for boyfriends. I received the 1L curriculum in the mail, and it looks intense."
"I'll take your word for it. The thought of studying long hours is too much for me to handle right now."
"That's because you got booted from Harvard, and now you're a hotshot speechwriter 3 months removed from the last time you'll ever take a written exam."
"Speechwriter, yes. Hotshot? Far from it. More like rookie peon at the beck and call of Bill Myers, who writes almost everything himself, except occasionally when he rewrites what I've written."
"You're making a salary, and you have some job security. Is anyone in his party even a legitimate opponent in the primaries?"
"Not at the moment. But so goes Iowa in January, so goes the rest of the campaign. And Iowa has produced some sleepers over the years. But if Ward wins the nomination, I'll be working around the clock on the way to the election next November. So we'll both be busy. I'll just be getting paid for my work, rather than the other way around."
Becca grabbed his arm as they walked away from the law library. "Don't rub it in." They headed off campus toward Foggy Bottom. "Let's stop at the 19th for a beer," she said. "Like the old days."
Jack shook his head. "Let's find somewhere else. We need a new place, you and me. The 19th reminds me of college."
They walked down Providence and found a bar called O'Reilly's. They sat at a tall pub table by the window, ordered Guinness, and started their own tradition. The 2 weeks leading to the start of law school were special for Becca Eckersley. It was the first time, other than their brief rendezvous in Yellowstone Park, that she openly displayed her love for Jack. During her senior year, they walked together without holding hands and kissed goodbye only in the abandoned hallways of campus buildings when both were sure they were alone. But after a summer of only seeing each other occasionally, with Jack working on Senator Ward's campaign and Becca in North Carolina, their reunion represented a different time in their lives. They met for dinner without worry of being spotted and stayed overnight without sneaking home the next morning. On the Sunday before law school started, the unofficial end of summer, they sat at the window table in O'Reilly's for the fourth time in 2 weeks. They decided it was, indeed, their new place. The food was good, and Becca was learning to tolerate the Guinness. The music was pop and top 40 at a volume that allowed conversation. A few undergrads were present, but mostly young professionals filled the booths and spent time at the bar. Their pizza was delivered, green pepper and olives, and they dug in.
"I was thinking about our living arrangements," Becca said, as she bit into a piece of pizza. She wore a sleeveless white blouse that showed off her tanned, toned arms. Becca's eyes reflected a seductive essence that Jack noticed immediately.
"Yes," he said.
"It seems silly to have two places when you stay at my apartment every night." Jack chewed his pizza.
"What are you trying to say, Eckersley?"
"We should live together."
"Not a chance."
Becca opened her mouth and feigned surprise. "Why?"
"Let's see, where should I start? First, we both have 12-month leases we can't get out of. And you should know that. I'm not even the lawyer here. Second, this whole thing."
Jack pointed to himself and then the pizza and then Becca.
"Is great. Going out to eat, staying up late and sleeping in. But school starts tomorrow, and soon you'll be studying like mad. I'll have to start working again, and when that happens, we'll both be happy to have a place by ourselves."
He looked up, as if thinking of a final point.
"Oh yeah. Then there's that whole thing about your father, and how he would rip the heart out of my chest if we lived together, so that's kind of a deterrent."
Becca took a sip of beer. "Okay, we'll keep our own places for now and talk again next year before we sign any leases."
"Deal."
They finished their pizza and beer and walked back to Becca's. Inside, Becca headed to the bedroom to change while Jack opened his MacBook and checked emails. There were a few from his bosses, asking Jack to draft something for the next week. He read the specifics and then checked the upcoming travel schedule.
"I've got to fly to California next week with Ward, leaving Tuesday and coming back Friday.
He was reading the itinerary from the screen, not looking at Becca, who walked out of the bedroom. When he got no answer, he finally looked up. She was posed in the doorway of the bedroom, wearing nothing but her bikini bottoms. The bedroom light reflected off her toned thighs and smooth olive skin.
"I just talked to my father," she said, holding her pose, "and he agrees with you about the living together thing. And he added that he would prefer you not be in my apartment past 10 o'clock on school nights, which this is."
She turned around and sauntered into the bedroom.
"Lock the door on your way out."
Jack shook his head. The image of her naked body burned in his mind. He wasn't sure if it was Southern girls in general who always found a way to get what they wanted, or Becca Eckersley in particular. Either way, he closed his laptop and walked quickly into her room, where she had removed her bikini bottoms, and he pretended to be startled.
"My father asked you to leave."
"Point taken," Jack said.
"Oh," Becca said, standing naked by the bed. "Was I making a point?"
Jack walked to her and put his hands on her slim waist. He kissed her as she unbuttoned his shirt. They fell onto the bed. Chapter 26. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 14, 2012, Day 10. She didn't risk being picked up in front of the Winchester for fear that Detective Madison was watching from the shadows and would follow them. She was being paranoid, she knew. She also knew paranoia kept her out of trouble. Kelsey pulled her leather coat closed as she walked out the back door of the Winchester and along a side street that led to the banks of Summit Lake. The sun was almost gone, and the sky was a dying blue. As it sunk behind the mountains, the sun streaked thin clouds plum purple and offered a pink glow to the lake. She pulled out her cell phone while she walked and tried Penn Courtney. It had been over a week since she arrived in Summit Lake, two since she took the Eckersley story. Penn answered on the first ring, and as Kelsey walked, she brought him up to date on the most recent developments. He was not happy about the trouble she was getting herself into, but Kelsey knew the lore of a cover-up and the idea of events beating everyone else to the Eckersley story was enough to placate him for the time being. The real point of Kelsey's journey to Summit Lake was clear. This was a time for her to heal and recover. Take some time off and lay low. There was never any confusion about that. And after an initial protest, Kelsey was fully willing to kill a month under the ruse of chasing a story. The problem was, while sniffing for a story she thought didn't exist, she found one. And now she was neck deep in it, possibly in some trouble and about to make things worse. She kept the details of her plan vague when Penn pressed her for specifics. When he requested something of substance from her, a draft or outline, Kelsey promised she'd get something to him soon.
"Tonight," Penn said.
"I'll try."
"Try? I just gave you a deadline. I want to see what you have."
"I've got something going on tonight, Penn. I'll get something out to you tomorrow. Promise."
"You'd better have some guts to it."
"Trust me," Kelsey said as she walked. "I'll be in touch."
"Before you go, remember one thing," Penn said.
"What's that?"
"I've allowed you to expense everything on this trip."
"You encouraged it, actually," Kelsey said.
"Okay, I'll go that far. But know this, bail money is not included. So don't call me at 2 a.m. if this plan of yours breaks bad."
"Let's not get carried away."
"I'm serious, Kelsey."
"I know you are. I'll touch base when I know more."
"One more thing."
Kelsey waited. "Yes?"
"You're the best I've got, and just be careful, okay?"
"Always. Thanks, Penn." She stuffed the phone in her purse as she approached the corner of Spokane Avenue. She checked her watch. 5:53 p.m. She was about to sit on the corner bench when the SUV pulled up. The passenger side window rolled down.
"We've got to stop meeting this way," Peter said.
Kelsey shook her head and offered a nervous smile. She pulled open the door and climbed in.
"Are you sure you're okay with this?"
"Not really, because I don't know exactly what I signed up for. Why couldn't I pick you up at the hotel?"
"Let's get out of here and I'll explain."
They drove 15 minutes into the mountains and pulled over to a scenic overlook. The vastness of the lake was in front of them, and the homes of Summit Lake were nestled in a neat pocket below, glowing in the evening darkness.
"Has anyone been around to talk to you?" Kelsey asked, as they pulled to a stop.
"Anyone who?" Peter asked.
"Any police, to talk to you about breaking into the county building the other night?"
"No. Why? What's happening?"
"One of the detectives on the Eckersley case paid me a visit last night. Told me to stop snooping around and go back to Miami."
"Really? Not sure he has the authority to kick you out of town."
"Normally, I'd agree with you. But he started asking questions about stolen documents from the county building and where I was that night."
"What did you tell him?"
"I acted like I didn't know what he was talking about, but I don't think it was a very good bluff. He told me they're reviewing surveillance tapes that show two individuals entering the building after business hours with a stolen access card."
"Uh-oh."
"Yeah, we're in trouble. I wanted to give you a heads up. You might also mention to your friend who got you the card that some heat might come down on him."
"So with all this heat, as you call it, about to come down on us, you thought it was a good idea to pull another B&E?
Kelsey smiled at his sarcasm. "Not a good idea, but my only shot at finishing what I started here."
"What's with this case?" Peter asked. "Why is it so important to you?"
Kelsey stared out the windshield, where the dying sun laid a cherry runway quivering across Summit Lake. In her heart was empathy toward Becca, who, like Kelsey, had undergone a brutal assault. That no one ever paid the price for this crime was something Kelsey could not turn her back on. She was hungry for closure, and she couldn't leave Summit Lake without it. "I'm not sure," she finally said, "but I know too much about this girl to leave with all these questions floating around." She shrugged. "Just not enough to find the answers."
"Which is why you asked me to help you break into some woman's house tonight."
"Correct. I know you're sticking your neck out again for me, something you don't have to do. I'm nervous to try this by myself, and I hope to hell you don't get in any trouble for what we did the other night." Peter smiled.
"You're worth a little trouble."
Kelsey's cell phone buzzed. She looked down and read the text message. "Okay, Ray's got her out of the house. They're headed to dinner. We've got about an hour, hour and a half tops."
"Let's go,"
Peter said, backing out of the parking spot and starting down the mountain road.
"Where does the old lady live?"
10 minutes later, they pulled to the front of Millie's house. Peter parked in the driveway and turned off his headlights. They sat in darkness and stared at the house, lighted now only by two porch lights and a stray living room lamp.
"Okay," Peter said. "Now what? You've got a key?"
"It's not that complicated," Kelsey said. "Come on." They slowly moved up the front walk, making sure no neighbors were watching. When they reached the front door, Kelsey simply turned the knob and pushed.
"You've got to be kidding me," Peter said.
Ray said she'd make sure the door was unlocked. She handed Peter a small flashlight. "Let's go." Inside, they closed the door behind them. "No lights, just in case the neighbor saw her leave. A blazing house will draw suspicion."
"Got it," Peter said. "What is it again I'm looking for?"
"A journal, like a diary."
"Description?"
"That's it. Let's go upstairs first." In Millie's bedroom, they carefully took 15 minutes to look through dresser drawers and nightstands and under mattresses and in old boxes in the closet.
"If I find something inappropriate," Peter said, pulling open the nightstand drawer, "I swear to God I'll scream."
Kelsey laughed. She's in her 80s.
"Then I'll scream louder."
"Hurry up," Kelsey said, laughing as she entered the closet.
"Nothing out here," Peter finally said.
"Yeah," Kelsey said, walking out of the closet a minute later. "Nothing in there either." They headed to the second bedroom and went through the same routine, taking painstaking efforts to leave everything they touched and looked under in the exact position they found it. Another 15 minutes passed. They took a quick tour of the hallway closet. Nothing. They were in the house for 30 minutes when they walked down the stairs to the first floor and picked their way through the dining room armoire. Kelsey thought they were onto something when she stumbled across a bound book in the bottom cabinet, but it turned out to be Millie's wedding album. Another 10 minutes were spent in the dining room, and 10 more fruitlessly in the living room. Kelsey started to sweat, and her palms became clammy. They'd been at it for nearly an hour. They set in on the kitchen, flashlight beams floating through cabinets and pantries, over baking goods and plastic jars of cereal. Finally, Kelsey placed the flashlight on the kitchen table, its beam still now as it came to rest against the backsplash. She took a defeated breath. With no journal, she was stuck. A stale plan of tracking down Libby Houston and asking about the journal formed in Kelsey's mind, but she knew it would be difficult. She'd have to find Libby first, and then convince her to talk. No guarantee of that. And even if Libby agreed to meet, she might not know a thing. This was all assuming Detective Madison hadn't already paid Libby a visit himself. Kelsey ran a hand over her face and shook her head. Peter walked over to her.
Hey.
She looked up at him.
I'm sorry. I wish I could find it for you.
Kelsey nodded and closed her eyes. Peter moved closer and wrapped his arms around her. She rested her cheek on his chest and surprised herself by returning the gesture and locking her fingers behind his back. She thought briefly of the self-help books that suggested she may not be able to tolerate a man's touch for some time, but she felt good in Peter's arms, safe even.
I wish I could do more for you,
Peter said into her ear. It's okay. I was reaching, I know, for something to help me with this story, for something that will provide the information I can't find on my own. Becca's journal was all I had left.
Some secrets are meant to be kept, Peter said.
She adjusted her position and looked up at him. Their faces were close. His eyes, in the dimly lit kitchen of Millie's house, were caring and genuine. He smelled from aftershave and lotion. She looked at his full lips, thought of what it would feel like to kiss him, and if she was ready, and if she could handle it, and whether this was the place to do it, or if they should just get the hell out of there. As these thoughts passed through her mind, Peter's head tilted just a bit, and his face came toward hers. Kelsey blinked a few times before her eyes widened. She moved her hands to his face and smiled. Say that again. Peter shook his head.
Say what?
What you just said.
I wish I could do more to help you?
No, after that. Peter thought for a second.
Some secrets are meant to be kept.
Yes! With her hands still on his face, Kelsey tilted her head back and laughed. She remembered her time in his kitchen a couple days before, when she sat with Millie and drank sweet tea and listened to the old lady reveal things about the night Becca was killed, about the night her daughter, Libby Houston, sat with Becca at the cafe and talked with her just hours before she died. There was something about that conversation that stuck with her, something Kelsey couldn't define until she heard Peter say it. She looked at the flashlight, which was resting on the table and shining across the room, illuminating the kitchen countertop and backsplash. Captured in its beam was a row of cookbooks. Kelsey recognized one of them as Millie's secret recipe binder. Kelsey remembered Millie standing at the counter mixing her sweet tea. Is your recipe available to the public? Kelsey had asked. Oh no, sweetheart. This book is strictly off limits. If I let people know what was in here, all my secrets would be revealed. I'm 86 years old. My secrets are all I have left. Kelsey broke free from Peter's embrace, grabbed the flashlight, and walked quickly to the binder. She pulled it out of the row and dropped it flat on the counter. She opened the cover, flipped through dozens of laminated recipes until there were no more pages to turn. And there it was. In the back pocket of the recipe binder, a small hard-covered journal rested. In a girl's cursive was scrawled, Becca Eckersley. Chapter 27. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, October 12, 2011, 4 months before her death. It only became an amazing thing later. At first, it was complete shock and disbelief. Law school began on a muggy day at the end of August, where the humidity hung still in the air and stuck to her face when she walked from the cool air conditioning of the campus buildings. September was more merciful, and by the time October rolled through, the dog days were gone, and everyone had their eyes set on the cold and brutal winters DC knew well. Becca was putting in 12 and 15-hour days between classes and study. Jack was gone much of September, either traveling or working late at Senator Ward's office. She hadn't bothered to tell him about the vomiting, since it came only in the mornings and was mostly cleared up by the time she was into her day. For the first week, she accused influenza. But when day 14 approached, she got suspicious. School, civil procedure and contracts in particular, had her so preoccupied she couldn't remember the details of her period the previous month, but she was definitely late now. She bought a pregnancy test at the corner pharmacy on the way home and now sat on the lid of the closed toilet as she waited for the results. When they came, she tried again. After 5 more minutes, her perfect little life and the next 10 years, which were planned out and lined up like a precise set of dominoes, toppled. She tried Jack's cell phone and got his voicemail, where she left a frantic message asking for a call back. She texted him 5 minutes later, then finally jumped into her car and drove downtown to his office. She'd been there before, during Senator Ward's courting phase in the summer, when she tagged along with Jack on the grand tour. This was her first visit during working hours, and her first while Jack was a true employee of Milt Ward for president. Senator Ward maintained an official office at the Dirksen Senate Office Building, and that was where Jack spent most of his time when he was not on the road. She parked in employee parking off Constitutional Avenue and walked inside. "Hi," she said to the secretary, in the best calmed-down voice she could find. She asked for Jack. "I'm his..." She paused a moment as she tried to figure out what exactly she was. A friend? A girlfriend? It didn't matter, because she wasn't his wife, and that meant pure hell when it came time to discuss this with her parents. "I just need to talk with him," she finally said. "He was with Senator Ward on Capitol Hill earlier today, but let me see where he is now." The secretary picked up the phone. "Oh, you're back," she said. "There's a young woman here to see you." She covered the receiver with her hand and looked at Becca with an expression that begged for a name. "Becca Eckersley." "Becca Eckersley," the secretary said slowly. "Okay." She replaced the phone. Through security, then down the hallway, left at the T and then the second door on the right. Becca smiled and headed through the metal detectors. Once through, she started down the hall. Before she could reach the aforementioned T, Jack appeared with a broad smile, wearing the tie she'd gave him when he officially accepted the position.
"Can you believe I wore this tie the first time you're at the office?"
Becca forced a smile. "Looks good. We need to talk." He raised his eyebrows.
"Okay, come into my office."
They walked around the corner into Jack's office. His isolated laptop sat on the desk, with shallow stacks of papers in a semicircle. He closed the door and offered Becca a chair.
"What's up?"
She took a deep breath. "I'm pregnant." Jack's lips stayed sealed together and his forehead wrinkled. "I know," Becca said.
"Well," Jack said, "the cliched response is, how did this happen? But I'll start with, are you sure?"
"I've taken 2 pregnancy tests."
"I didn't even know this was a suspicion."
"I didn't either, until today. I haven't felt well. And with school and the hectic schedule, I thought it was the flu."
"Okay,"
Jack said, sitting behind his desk. After a few seconds, he said,
"Holy shit. Let's not freak out here."
"But here's the problem. There's so much to freak out about. I'm a pregnant 1L student at GW Law. That might be a first. I mean, how do you finish law school when you have a baby? Then there's my parents. Holy shit is right, Jack. I can't imagine telling my father. And finally, there's you and me, and what this means to us and each other, and our future." Becca was on the verge of tears.
"All right," Jack said. "So there's lots to think about. Even if we were married, and you were out of law school, there'd be a lot to think about. First of all, if we do the math, you're due when? Summer?"
Becca nodded. She'd already gotten that far. "Not sure, but probably May or June."
"So that shouldn't affect your first year of school, other than the obvious. But you can finish year 1. Then we either hire help,
or think about taking a year off. If we talk to the right people, a year off is possible, and I'm sure Milt knows a few people.
Becca stared out the window as Jack talked. There were many reasons to come here and talk to him, but the main reason was because he always calmed her down when she faced something she couldn't handle on her own. So far, what he said was correct. And for the first time since this morning, she considered that she still one day might be a lawyer.
"Second," Jack went on, "I'll sit right next to you when you tell your parents, so we'll have that to look forward to together. And lastly, this does nothing to us. Nothing bad, anyways. At least according to me."
She knew she loved him. Knew it the previous summer when they said it to each other for the first time, and she knew throughout her senior year as their relationship grew. It was confirmed on their trip to Yellowstone when they skipped graduation and shared a week together under the blue Wyoming sky. But here, today, Becca loved him more for being a man and for never thinking of anything other than how to get through this situation together.
"There is one other problem, though," Jack said.
"What's that?" Becca asked.
"We've got to figure out how to get married, and very quickly."
Chapter 28. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 15, 2012. Day 11. The sun was an orange ball just above the horizon, its edges sharp and visible at such a young hour, and its reflection spread like marmalade across Summit Lake. The light peeked through the curtains of Peter's living room window and fell softly on Kelsey's face. She tried to open her eyes, but the sunlight was too intense. Her neck ached from the awkward position she was in, and when she sat up, she realized where she was. Peter was asleep next to her, his arm draped behind her neck and his leg propped up on the coffee table. They came back to Peter's house the night before, after finding Becca's journal in Millie's recipe book. Together they read it, cover to cover, learning the names of Becca's friends and the dynamics of her relationships. Becca was in love with Jack, and Kelsey suspected there was a problem with her relationship with Jack's best friend, Brad. Kelsey read the neat cursive writing for 3 hours, taking notes along the way, details coming together in her mind, until her eyes drooped and the journal fell softly onto her chest. Peter sat next to her, and soon they were both asleep. Now, with the sun bright in her eyes, Kelsey sat up. She had been sleeping with her head on Peter's chest while they both slouched on the living room couch. Denying the pain in her neck, she surveyed her surroundings.
"Sorry," she rubbed her face. "I fell asleep."
"Me too," Peter said, in a groggy morning voice.
"Ouch."
He pulled his stiff leg off the coffee table. Kelsey stood up and ran a hand through her hair.
"What time is it?"
Peter checked his watch.
"Just after 6.
"I must have crashed."
"Me too. It happens after an adrenaline rush like we had."
"Can I use the bathroom?"
"Of course,"
Peter said. He pointed to the door down the hall.
"There's a package of toothbrushes in the top drawer, so help yourself."
"Thank you." Kelsey headed to the bathroom and shut the door. "Dear God," she said, when she saw her image in the mirror. The left side of her head was a bird's nest of tangled hair, and her cheek was covered in a red roadmap of wrinkles with a prominent depression from the button on Peter's breast pocket. She washed her face, brushed her teeth, and ran a comb through her hair. Her mind played tug of war, one part wanting to reminisce about the almost kiss she shared with Peter, the other, more analytical part, wanting to get back to Becca's journal and sift through the cast of characters who were in it. She finally emerged from the bathroom a few minutes later, looking more put together. Her hair was pulled into a ponytail and her teeth minty with fluoride. They switched places, smiling awkwardly at each other as they passed. Peter closed the door, then she shook her head. "What the hell am I doing?" she asked herself. Peter popped his head out of the bathroom door.
"What's that?"
She waved him back in. "Nothing." She went to the couch and paged through Becca's journal. A few minutes later, Peter walked out of the bathroom, also looking more presentable.
"Want to get breakfast?"
he asked her. "Sure," Kelsey smiled. Outside, the sky sponged up the colors of the rising sun. Buds on the trees looked to have blossomed into leaves overnight. The air was crisp and fresh, and the temperature rising with the sun.
The smell from wood-burning fireplaces mixed with the pine of the forest. It was spring in Summit Lake. They walked down Maple Street and turned on Nokomis Avenue, where they found a breakfast place. They ordered pancakes and eggs. Sipping coffee, the awkwardness of waking next to each other quickly faded as they recalled the previous night's journey.
So, I fell asleep right about when Becca headed home for Christmas with Jack.
I finished it, Kelsey said.
And?
Becca was an interesting girl, for sure. She was clearly in love with Jack, and we know she married him after she found out she was pregnant, but there were other men in her life.
Brad, right? One of her college friends?
Yes, and if I can read between the lines, I can imagine Brad maybe believing his relationship with Becca was more than platonic. But that's not all. There were other men Becca wrote about. A professor she had a somewhat secretive relationship with.
She was sleeping with him?
No, at least Becca didn't come out and say as much in her journal. But he's mentioned enough to make him a worthwhile candidate to track down. And there was also an ex-boyfriend in the picture. A guy from high school who made frequent trips to the GWU campus from Harvard. Also someone I'd like to talk to.
How about the husband? Jack. Shouldn't you talk to him first?
Talk to him for sure, but not first. I want to find out who these other guys are. See if they can provide any insight into Becca and their relationships with her. Then see what they know about Jack. Once I've got all that, I'll pay him a visit.
You don't think the police have already found these guys?
I'm not sure what the police have found. According to Commander Ferguson, the state investigators are stuck on the theory of a simple burglary turned ugly.
But that theory has to be based on something. Some evidence they found?
Becca's purse was missing. That's it. At least that's all Commander Ferguson knows about why they're running so hard with a burglary angle.
And you're not buying that theory?
Not even close. With some help from Commander Ferguson, it looks like the person who killed Becca not only knew her well, but quite possibly was close to her.
Like someone who loved her?
Maybe. But my first move is to track these guys down and talk to them, and I've got to do it quickly.
So where do we start? I want to help.
You sure about that?
Absolutely. Whatever you need.
I get the feeling from Detective Madison's visit the other night that we don't have a lot of time. The first thing we have to do is identify the people in Becca's journal. I went back through it last night and couldn't find a single last name attached to any of her friends, so let's start there. Kelsey pulled out her notes. Jack lives in Green Bay, Brad in Maryland. At least that's where they're from. Who knows where they are now? It sounds like the roommate, Gail, lives in Florida but goes to school at Stanford. Kelsey wrote block letters on a napkin. Jack and Gail. She slid the napkin across the table. If you want to help, she said, looking Peter in the eye, and you're not worried about the trouble we might be headed for from the county building, then I'd ask you to find out who Gail is and track her down. Talk to her. Find out what she knows about Becca and Jack. Get me Jack's last name and any information Gail is willing to provide. If you're feeling it with her, if you have a good rapport, tell her my theory of what might have transpired between Becca and Jack and get her reaction. Peter put his hand on the napkin and began to pull it toward him. Kelsey put her hand over his and stopped the napkin's progress. If you're worried, Peter, about getting in trouble for any of this, then you should back out now. I'm sure you can hide behind some sort of physician immunity about looking at that autopsy and using that card to get into the building. Currently, as we sit here, you're likely in less trouble than I am. I'm okay with it, if you want to keep it that way. Peter maintained eye contact and pulled his hand and the napkin from her grip.
I'll find Becca's roommate and talk to her. I'll let you know what I find out.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And what's your plan? Track down the other guys in her life?
Absolutely.
Let's get going, Peter said. We've got work to do.
Chapter 29. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, December 21st, 2011, 2 months before her death. The plan was to wait until the second trimester to tell their parents, under the ruse of making sure the pregnancy was without complication and the baby was healthy. In reality, it gave them a little breathing room. They had nearly 2 months to figure things out and lay some groundwork that might help them look less crazy. If all went according to their flimsy strategy, Jack and Becca would sit down in Greensboro for Thanksgiving dinner and tell the Eckersleys they were going to be grandparents. Jack worked hard to hold it together, but Becca wasn't buying his eternal optimism that all would work out, or that her parents, after the dust settled, would be thrilled. Becca played the scenario in her mind of the moment she dropped the bomb, and no matter how hard she tried, she could not realistically see her father being excited about his 22-year-old daughter being pregnant and unmarried. Her father was a powerful man in North Carolina. He carried influence and a persona. He was getting ready to hand over his firm to her brother and the other partners as he transitioned to being a judge. And Becca knew such a move required a clean background, not only for her father, but for his family. A pregnant, unmarried daughter who dropped out of law school was not the family portrait with which her father could win the bench. That thought was what brought them to the courthouse in D.C. Becca understood the logistics of a formal wedding and the impossibility of it occurring in her current situation. Instead, a justice of the peace married them in a very informal ceremony. It was not how they planned things or how the narrative of their lives was meant to go. But if she and Jack learned anything over the last year, it was that the road of life has detours, and the long way around can sometimes be a shortcut. After the justice pronounced them married, they kissed, and then sat behind a desk in the processor's office and filled out forms. They were told they needed to get their marriage certificate finalized and took a copy of instructions on how to do so. They spent a single night at the Four Seasons in downtown D.C., where they celebrated with an expensive dinner and a nice bottle of wine from which Becca sneaked two or three sips. Saturday was a quiet day, shared at Becca's apartment, before Jack flew to New York on Sunday, and Becca hit the books for an exam. They started the weekend as boyfriend and girlfriend, and ended it as husband and wife. For the next few weeks, they settled into a routine of being a secretly married couple with a baby on the way whom no one knew about. And when Thanksgiving finally rolled around, the time they originally agreed to tell Becca's parents, they choked. Neither could settle on the right approach. And so the 2 nights spent at the Eckersleys' house in Greensboro were filled with anxiety and whispered conversations. They headed back to D.C. on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. Jack had a busy schedule until Christmas, then a week off that coincided with part of Becca's break. They planned to head to Green Bay for Becca to meet Jack's parents. That Jack would be introducing his wife and explaining that his mom and dad would soon be grandparents was sure to make this Christmas one to remember. Becca finished her final exam week with back-to-back exams of civil procedure and contracts and never felt more relief. She sent a text to Jack when she was done. "Just finished. Celebrating by myself at O'Reilly's. I'll have one for you." It was mid-afternoon, and O'Reilly's was moderately crowded with law students and business people at the end of their week and the end of their semester. Jack was traveling with Senator Ward and not due back until the day before Christmas Eve, 2 days from now. The doctor completed the calculations, and it was determined that they conceived at the beginning of the school year, when they shared time together at the end of summer and forgot about the world. The due date was officially stamped as May 18th, which was 2 weeks after final exams. The timing was not perfect, but she knew it could be worse, and still could be if the baby came early and caused her to miss finals. But Becca was staying optimistic for delivering in a narrow window of time that would allow her not only to finish her first year, but also get things together enough to possibly return on schedule the following fall. They discussed the other options of either taking a year off and then returning full-time, or switching to part-time and graduating later than planned. Either way, after 4 months of pregnancy, Becca had options. Under close scrutiny in the bathroom mirror, her belly had not yet betrayed that a baby was growing there, even from a profile view. For now, she kept her secret to herself. Besides a few study buddies, Becca made no close friends during her first semester of law school, and with Gail on the other side of the country, she wasn't concerned with anyone discovering her secret before she decided to reveal it. At O'Reilly's, she ordered a salad and a Sprite and felt the weight of her first semester rise from her shoulders. She had 2 weeks to relax. She pulled her iPhone from her purse and scrolled through her emails, hoping to see one from Gail. They promised to let each other know when they finished their finals. She just opened her inbox when the stool on the other side of the table dragged across the ground and someone sat down with her. Becca looked up, shocked at first, and then happy to see her old friend Tom Jorgensen, her old logic professor who left GWU for a position at Cornell. Tom, what are you doing here?
Hello, Becca Eckersley, he said.
Look at you. Becca ran a hand over her face. You've grown an Ivy Leaguer. I'm surprised Cornell allows facial hair on professors. I thought they were only for students. Tom Jorgensen smiled.
They're encouraged, actually. What do you think?
Becca puckered her lips. Very handsome. How's the new gig?
Good. Could be better.
Better? You don't like being at the top of the food chain?
No. The job's great. University is top-notch, and I've never been part of a better institution.
Becca squinted her eyes. So, what's wrong? Tom shrugged.
I guess I don't understand why you turned Cornell down.
Becca sat silent for a few seconds. How did you know I turned them down?
Becca, I pulled a lot of strings to get you accepted to their law program. Stuck my neck out like I've never done before, in a position where I haven't yet fully found my footing. I told all the people with decision-making abilities what a great asset you'd be, and you returned the favor by saying no.
Tom, I didn't know you did any of that for me. I heard from GW first, and it's my dad's alma mater. I never really considered going anywhere else, unless GW was a no.
What happened to the discussion we had about finally being able to spend time with each other?
Well, Becca said, I think becoming a student at the university in which you work would put us in the same situation.
So why haven't I heard from you?
I've been busy with law school, and we live hundreds of miles from each other.
Okay, so I'm just an idiot who misread our friendship.
No, you didn't misread anything, but logistically it's hard to get together for coffee when we live in different states.
I just wish you'd have considered Cornell more closely. It's a great opportunity, and we'd be closer.
Becca stared at her old professor, feeling confused and sad for him. Before she could respond, a woman walked through the door and directly over to their table.
You are a son of a bitch.
Tom Jorgensen looked up, then closed his eyes.
Jesus Christ, what are you doing, Elaine?
What am I doing?
You don't have the right to ask me questions. Not anymore.
She looked at Becca.
How old are you?
Becca opened her palms.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm Elaine Jorgensen, Tom's wife.
Becca looked at Tom. What the hell?
Elaine, Tom said, let's go outside.
Of course.
Now that I caught you, you finally want to talk to me.
Listen, Becca said, he never told me he was married, and nothing's going on between us. I haven't seen him for a year, since he was at George Washington.
But now you're conveniently having lunch with my husband.
No, I was having lunch by myself, and he interrupted me.
Tom, she said, stand up. We're leaving.
Professor Jorgensen stood like a dog following a command. Elaine looked at Becca and pointed a finger at her face.
Stay away from my husband.
She grabbed Tom by the arm and pushed him out the door. Becca swallowed hard and, without moving her head, glanced around the bar and absorbed the stares. Slowly, people got back to the business of eating and drinking.
Damn, Eckersley. You sure know how to make a scene.
Becca looked over her shoulder. Richard Walker, her high school boyfriend, stood next to her.
First a cheesehead, and now some slimy dude cheating on his lady.
Still rattled, her hands shook. Becca quickly stood and hugged Richard. The last time she saw him was a year before when she and Jack spent Christmas in Summit Lake.
Good to see you too,
Richard said, holding her tight.
What's wrong?
Becca shook her head and released her grip around his shoulders. Oh, just a little disturbed, that's all.
By Professor Numbnuts?
Richard pointed to the door.
What's his story? Do I need to kick someone's ass?
He's an old professor of mine who was a little needy. I never knew he was married, and now... Becca shook her head. His wife actually thinks we're involved. Richard made an ugly face and shook his head.
Has that school gone completely nuts? First know-nothings from Wisconsin, and now stalker professors?
Richard cocked his head sideways.
So you're not sleeping with him?
Becca slapped his shoulder. No, the whole thing's just creepy. Keep me company while I eat. What are you doing here?
Just got done with finals. Heading home for 2 weeks. You too, right?
Becca nodded. Tomorrow, yeah. They sat down.
Haven't seen you for a while, Richard said.
Yeah, it's been a long time. There was a pause.
You still seeing that guy?
Becca nodded again.
That's too bad.
Stop it.
Is it serious?
Yes. Richard stared at her a minute.
Like, he's the one serious?
Becca looked into his eyes. He's the one, Richard. He took a deep breath.
I should have tried harder, he said.
What are you talking about?
To get you back. I visited you a couple times freshman year, but I was too dumb back then to know what I was losing. I should have worked harder. Maybe you and I would be celebrating the end of finals together now.
Becca motioned back and forth. We are.
Only by accident.
Becca smiled. I need a friend right now, okay? Not a lecture and not sobbing.
Wow, Richard said. You're going to be a good lawyer. Completely heartless.
Becca rubbed his hand in apology.
Fine, Richard said. Just friends. Tell me how bad your first semester sucked.
Chapter 30. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 15th, 2012, day 11. After leaving the restaurant, Kelsey and Peter took off in opposite directions. Peter headed home to start his research into Becca's roommate, while Kelsey walked to the Winchester in hopes of a shower and change of clothes before starting the next leg of the Eckersley journey. With her purse over her shoulder and Becca's journal nestled inside, Kelsey made her way along the lakefront until she reached Tahoma Avenue, where she headed west toward Maple Street and the entrance to the Winchester. Halfway down the block, she stopped. Ahead, in the semicircle drive in front of the hotel, three state police cars sat with rolling red and blue lights. A single officer stood in front of the building, talking into the radio on his shoulder and occasionally looking up at the top floor rooms. Kelsey stepped into the alcove of an art gallery and took a deep breath. She peeked out and then reminded herself that hiding in the shadows gathered more attention than simply walking down the street. She gathered her wits, stepped out of the gallery, and quickly walked the other way, back toward the lakefront and then south along Shore Drive. With her heart pounding, she kept her eyes on the steeple of St. Patrick's Church as she walked. She passed the docks of Stilt Row. When she reached Tomahawk Avenue, she turned right and walked to the corner of Maple. Across the street was Millie's Coffee House. A few cars drove past before Kelsey crossed. She snuck a peek to her right and saw the flashing squad cars a few blocks away at the Winchester. Pulling open the door to the cafe, Kelsey walked in and saw Ray behind the counter. It didn't take much, just Ray's quick eye contact and subtle head shake for Kelsey to know something was wrong. Before she could retreat out the door, though, Detective Madison appeared from the back of the cafe.
Actually, Detective, Ray said, just as he emerged from the back hallway where the restrooms were located. It was enough to take his attention away from the front of the cafe where Kelsey stood. I think I do know who you're talking about. Brown-haired girl, real pretty, with, like, caramel eyes, writes for that magazine.
Yeah, that's her,
Madison said, resting his elbows on the bar and turning his back to the front of the cafe.
You seen her around here?
Yeah, Ray said, running a hand through her hair. She's come in a couple of times for coffee.
She been in recently?
Couple days ago. Let me get you a coffee. It's on the house.
I appreciate it.
Detective Madison grabbed his cell phone from his breast pocket and scrolled through emails. While his eyes were on his phone, Ray looked at Kelsey and gestured upstairs with her thumb.
There you go, Detective.
Thanks. You talked to her at all while she was here?
Kelsey slowly backed away, turned, and snaked through the front door just as a couple was entering the cafe. Outside, Kelsey now recognized the unmarked state cruiser parked around the corner. She walked quickly to the alley behind the cafe and turned in just as a state trooper pulled off Maple Street and crept along Tomahawk.
What the hell?
Kelsey muttered to herself. She looked down the alley and then up the stairs that led to Ray's apartment. She took the stairs two at a time, twisted the handle, and ducked inside the apartment just as the state trooper turned and slowly crawled down the alley. She dumped her purse on the kitchen table and slumped into a chair. She couldn't go back to the hotel. Her rental car was probably impounded, and she was sure Peter's house was infested with police by now. She pulled out her cell and called him, then hung up when she got his voicemail. She texted him that police were outside her hotel, Madison was looking for her, and state detectives were likely to pay Peter a visit soon. Then she sat at Ray's kitchen table, pulled her MacBook from her purse, and started writing. The police didn't want Becca Eckersley's story told. That much was obvious. At least, they didn't want a reporter to tell it. Kelsey pictured herself on the phone in the police station, asking Penn for the bail money he promised not to give her. She wasn't sure she'd make it out of Summit Lake, but as much as she knew about Becca, sure as hell would. In an hour, she turned out 2,000 words for her article. Besides quick sentences and short paragraphs scribbled on her notepad over the past 10 days, the pages she produced while hiding in Ray's apartment were the first she had written on the Eckersley case. There was no style to the writing, mostly bullet points. She began with the murder itself, reviewing the details she gained from Commander Ferguson and from the medical records, then covered some of Becca's past and her time at George Washington University. She jumped ahead and made sure to get on paper that Becca was likely married and was definitely pregnant at the time she died. She included as many details as she could remember about the autopsy and toxicology report, then wrote down the names of Becca's friends from college and also the other men who were swarming her at the time of her death. Her efforts resulted in 10 pages of cluttered mess, but at least it was a start and something for Penn to work from if she were unable to continue the story. She attached it to an email and sent it to Penn's inbox just as she heard footsteps climbing the stairs outside. Ray pushed open the door and quickly closed it behind her. She pulled the curtains to the side, looked down at the alley for a minute to make sure no one was behind her, then turned to Kelsey. "Holy cow, girl. You shook the wrong beehive." Chapter 31. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, December 31st, 2011, 1 month before her death. Becca and Jack returned from Green Bay the day after Christmas. The days passed in Green Bay without the big reveal they both planned. Becca was introduced as his girlfriend, not his wife, and her pregnancy remained a secret. The idea of their marriage and a baby only a few months away had become such a giant cover-up that it was getting too big to unload. Becca was nervous about telling Jack's parents such intimate details about herself the first time she met them and before her own mother knew. Christmas came and went, and their families were no closer to knowing the truth about them. More than a week had passed since her encounter with Tom Jorgensen, and Becca still held such mixed emotions that she never told Jack about it. That she spent an hour consoled by Richard Walker was also something she left out of the description of her celebratory trip to O'Reilly's. Becca decided to put Tom and Richard out of her mind as she headed to Summit Lake to spend 5 quiet days with Jack before he started his travels again the day after New Year's. The primaries kicked off with the Iowa caucus in January and could go on intensely until summer before a nominee was determined. Although no one really thought Milt Ward would have long to fight after Super Tuesday in March before he was crowned the presidential nominee. Even with a quick wrap of the primaries, Jack would still be on the road for over a month. And though not in play, the other states would need to be visited, rallies attended, and speeches given. Jack would have an occasional night or two when he was not traveling, but a straight week together was something Jack and Becca would not see for some time. Becca's parents handed over the keys to the Stilt house before they headed to Venice, Florida for the week. Mr. and Mrs. Eckersley's original plans to ski in Summit Lake over New Year's were trumped by a client who needed immediate attention down in Florida. The days in Summit Lake between Christmas and New Year's were a quiet time for Becca. She and Jack ventured out only for dinner or a movie, before scurrying back home to light a fire and climb under thick cotton blankets on the couch. There had been heavy snow over Christmas, and the sidewalks and streets were a mess of salt and slush. The mountains looked inviting, with so much white powder covering them, and Becca told Jack stories about how great the skiing was. In no condition to ski, Becca was happy to stash her textbooks for a couple of weeks, content to sit and relax while Jack typed on his computer and asked her to proof his work. On New Year's Eve, they had a late lunch in town and beat the crowds. They rented 3 movies and spent the night on the couch by the fire. At 5 to midnight, they turned on the countdown in Times Square and watched as a million people froze in the streets of New York. Jack was on his side on the couch with Becca on her back, her head under his left arm. He kissed her at New Year's as Auld Lang Syne played in the background.
I want you to know that even though none of this was planned, I only think of it as a fast forward, Jack said. I was going to marry you someday, and we were going to have kids someday too. It's just all happening sooner than we expected. But I don't have any regrets. I'm excited for us to be parents this year, and I'm proud to be your husband.
Well, shucks, Becca said, tears spilling from the corner of her eyes. You sure know how to make a knocked-up girl feel special.
I love you, he said.
I know you do, and I'm going to miss you like crazy while you're gone.
It's just until the middle of February, and I'll be home sporadically in between. For a night or two, but I'll be home.
Tell me the truth, okay?
Sure.
Do you think a baby is going to mess up your career?
How will our baby mess up my career?
Your boss will be running for president, and he'll need you by his side. What if this really happens, Jack? What if Milt Ward wins the election in a year from now? We've both heard the horror stories of what a president's staff goes through. The hours they work make first-year associates in New York look like slackers.
So I work long hours. If I need time off, I'll ask for it.
Come on, Jack. Everyone will want more time with their family, but you'll have an infant, and you'll be working 20 hours a day.
I don't think it'll be that bad.
Still, what are you going to do? You'll have to see the baby, and I'll need some help. I can't do it all by myself.
I'll help.
But will that cause stress at your job?
Maybe. I don't know yet. But I'm going to see my kid.
That's what I mean. What if taking time for your family causes you to lose your place with Milt's team?
He's not like that. Milt's a family man. He'll understand.
And if he doesn't?
I'll figure it out.
Becca took a deep breath. I know this job is your dream. I don't want to be the one to spoil it.
You're not spoiling anything. You're part of my dream. Now listen, it's a new year, and we've got tons to look forward to.
He kissed her. They watched New York celebrate for a while, then returned to their movie. They both fell asleep on the couch. It was a new year.